helped you. He's helped you sell your papers and your books and your TV. You helped create this monster, and now you're profiting off of him.
We're with you, Michelle Wolf, but if corporate media has got you down, maybe you should try WBAI. We're listener-supported community radio, questioning the mainstream narratives trumpeted by the news profiteers. But in order for this whole thing to work, we need your help. Please go to give2wbai.org to find out how you can support WBAI or call 516-620-3602. And thanks for supporting Free Speech Radio on WBAI New York.
On Saturday, June 30th, in less than 3 hours in a Park Slope kitchen in Brooklyn, you can come and learn how to eat on a budget, make tasty organic vegetarian meals, and tools of massage that will help prevent or manage diabetes, high blood pressure, or cancer at Cook to Live for the 21st Century with health educator and Congo dancer Fumaleo. That's Saturday, June 30th from 3 to 5:30 p.m. For more information, visit the website cooktolive.org. That's cooktolive.org, all lowercase.
Hello, WBAI listeners and supporters. Tune in Thursday, June 21st from 4 to 6 p.m. for the first report of 2018 from the WBAI Local Station Board. This month, you'll be introduced to the LSB officers and the PNB directors. They'll talk about their responsibilities, recent developments throughout the network, and ask for your ideas on how to build a stronger WBAI. So mark that date on your calendar. Thursday, June 21st, 4 to 6 p.m. The first report of 2018 from the WBAI Local Station Board. Only on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. Streaming at WBAI.org.
And welcome to Health Action here on listener-supported community radio, WBAI in New York. I'm Mark Hannay, Director of Metro New York Healthcare for All, and a member of the Health Action Collective that brings you this program every week, along with Bob Letter and Catherine Davis. In this week's program, in the first half, we're going to be getting an update on what's going on in Washington around healthcare and some related issues in Congress and under the Trump administration. And in the second half of the program, we're going to be taking a look at consumers' rights here in New York concerning insurers' new rate requests to the state for what they want to charge you next year for your health insurance. So stay tuned for all of that. But first, we'll start with the Health Action News for this week, taken from stories posted to KaiserHealthNews.org. As teacher strikes flared this spring in more than a half a dozen states from West Virginia to Arizona, protesting teachers bemoan stagnant salaries, overcrowded classrooms, and a lack of basic supplies like textbooks and computers. However, often missing from their hand-scrawled placards and fiery speeches was the issue that has contributed greatly to the financial woes of many U.S. schools, and that is skyrocketing health care costs, particularly insurance. Many teachers, like other public employees, have traditionally accepted a trade-off in contract negotiations. In exchange for relatively low salaries, they could expect relatively generous benefits, including pensions and low or no-cost health insurance premiums. However, in an era of $100,000-a-year drugs and government budget cuts, local school districts are struggling to find money to keep up their end of the bargain, forced to take away from classroom funding and even modest cost of living raises. Many cash-strapped school boards, cities, and legislatures view healthcare benefits as an unpredictable budget buster. Meanwhile, teachers are being asked to fork over more of their own paychecks to keep their healthcare coverage in place, even as budget cuts have impelled them to use their own money for classroom supplies and to crowdsource money for things like buying computers. While teacher strikes have ebbed now with the ending of the school year, deals brokered to end the recent walkouts mostly offered temporary fixes with no long-term solution in sight. The average teacher's salary in the U.S. has decreased by 4% over the past decade, adjusted for inflation, according to a report released in April by the National Education Association. During that time, public schools have seen their revenue shrink, with federal funding dropping nearly 20% over the decade. As this general funding has declined, the cost of insurance has gone up. State and local governments paid 14.5% more last year to cover a teacher and his or her family than they did a decade ago, again adjusted for inflation. Educators themselves have also felt the sting of growing health insurance costs, especially as public officials have shifted some more of the burden directly onto them. Teachers paid about 25.4% more last year to insure themselves and their families than they did a decade ago. The congressional newspaper The Hill reports that medical experts are cautioning that there are long-term health risks for migrant children who are separated from their parents, including irreplaceable harm to those children's lifelong development. Based on past research, children who are forcibly taken from their parents have demonstrated links to asthma, obesity, and cancer, in addition to tendencies towards substance abuse, developmental delays, and mental health issues. The age at which children are taken can also have a profound effect on their future health. Children under age 10 are of the most concern. Separation from parents and loved ones can cause toxic stress that disrupts brain development in children and have long-term health effects. The Trump administration recently began implementing its zero-tolerance policy, aggressively prosecuting adults attempting to cross the U.S.-Mexico border illegally. The policy has led to thousands of separations as a result of children and adults having to be prosecuted separately. The number of immigrant children being detained in government-run facilities has soared under the new policy. The practice has been widely denounced by those across the political spectrum. Senate Democrats have introduced legislation that would eliminate the practice. The legislation introduced by Senator Dianne Feinstein of California would allow only children to be separated from a parent if they're being abused, trafficked, or if a court decides it's in the best interest of the child. In a challenge to Attorney General Jeff Sessions, the legislation would prevent a child from being separated from a parent or legal guardian solely for the purpose of a policy goal of deterring individuals from migrating to the U.S. or for the policy goal of promoting compliance with civil immigration laws. More than 30 Democratic senators have signed on to the bill. And lastly, the website Stat reports that the drug company Calio, a maker of the opioid overdose antidote drug naltrexone, has been donating free cartons of the drug's auto-injectors to police agencies in recent years. Their drug charity program, known as Calio Cares, has generated a public relations windfall for the company since its branded Vizio auto-injectors hit the market 4 years ago. However, Stat reports that the auto-injectors donated to some police agencies through the program are just months away from expiration. Fresh off the production line, naloxone typically has a shelf life of 2 years. Calio, for its part, says patients prescribed Vizio can be expected to receive auto-injectors with a shelf life of over a year. While the Food and Drug Administration discourages donations of expired drugs, guidelines are lacking on whether companies should give away drugs on the verge of expiring. In 2014, when the FDA first approved Calio's auto-injectors, the company was a latecomer to the naloxone market. But the company believed they had a tactical advantage in form of their novel delivery mechanism that's easy for laypeople to use. However, Vizio was expensive. It cost nearly $600 for a two-pack, making it the most expensive naloxone product on the market. Other drug makers also raised their prices for naloxone, which a decade earlier could have been purchased for less than a dollar per dose. 6 months after the FDA's approval, Calio announced its charity program, which offered up to 200 auto-injectors to law enforcement agencies. By mid-2017, as the price of Vizio two-pack skyrocket to a whopping $4,500. Calio continued to give away hundreds of thousands of naloxone from Washington to Florida. The growth of their charity program, as it happened, coincided with calls from lawmakers to justify the price hikes. In general, the FDA warns that the drugs may become less effective or perhaps unsafe past an expiration date, but some studies suggest otherwise. Leading trade associations, including the American Pharmacists Association, haven't offered guidance on the donation of soon-to-be-expired drugs, and state laws vary. In a recent interview, the National Conference of State Legislatures found that three-quarters of states have laws that require donated drugs to be at least 3 to 9 months away from expiration. And that's the Health Action News for this week. We'll be back with our first segment in a moment, getting an update on what's happening in Washington around healthcare and related issues. Stay tuned. And welcome back to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In our first interview segment today, we're going to be checking in on what's going on in Washington with regard to health care and related programs, and in particular, the fight that's happening now over the future of the food stamp program. Joining us is Margarita George, who's co-executive director with Healthcare for America Now, and Ron Deutsch, who's executive director of the Fiscal Policy Institute based in Albany, actually. Welcome back to Health Action, Margarita and Ron.
Thanks for having us.
Ron, let's start with you, because I know you'll have to jump off the interview at a certain point. We want to get everything in. So let's focus a little bit on the food stamp fight. For people who may not be familiar with the food stamp program, what is it? How many people are on it? What kinds of people are on it? Tell us, give us a little Food Stamps 101.
Sure. The food stamp program, more commonly known now as the SNAP program, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, it was started decades ago as a way to make sure that people would get nutritious food and people in our country wouldn't go hungry. And it's been quite successful. It now serves over 40 million people nationwide, about 3 million of them in New York State. So, you know, everybody from families to children to seniors to veterans are all receiving SNAP benefits throughout the country right now. And the food stamp reauthorization comes up once every 5 years or so. So now we're in the midst of doing that. And we have bills in both the House and the Senate now that are very different bills.
So before we dig into that, what is the eligibility criteria for getting on food stamps? How does one qualify for the program?
It's primarily income related. So if your income is below a certain level, you would qualify for food stamps, and there's a couple of other criteria, but it's really just one of those programs that tends to be more means tested, where if you make below a certain amount of money that you would be able to access this program.
And my understanding is about 80% of the people who qualify for food stamps live at or below the poverty level. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Yeah, so it's mainly
I mean,
poor
certainly
people.
Something that's been an amazing poverty-fighting program as well.
Great. So let's dig into what's going on now around this. Both the Trump administration and its budget proposals earlier this year and subsequent to that, the House leadership have put forth some proposals for changes they want to see happen to the food stamp program. What are they suggesting?
Well, certainly, you know, the Trump administration, I think, came out really hard on the food stamp program and was actually looking at starting to deliver boxes of food to people, more like the kind of government cheese days where, you know, people would go and pick up cheese. But sadly, the House kind of followed suit and put together what we think is a very punitive bill. And actually, they included a great deal of new work requirements. They included a lot of provisions, in particular punitive sanctions, where if someone didn't meet their work requirements, they could be thrown off assistance for up to a year. And if they violated those work requirements again, they could lose it for almost 3 years. So there's a lot of really punitive work requirements in the House bill. It would also result in veterans and children and seniors losing SNAP benefits as well if they don't meet these new, more stringent criteria. And it also sets up a bureaucratic nightmare because now we're going to have to basically reauthorize people's food stamps monthly now, where it was usually done about once every 6 months. So it's going to be a lot more tracking, a lot more bureaucracy, which is surprising coming from the House that seems to dislike big government, as they would say. But so they failed to pass a bill back in April, and now they are looking to pass a new bill on June 22nd. So at the end of this week, they're looking to be trying to pass this bill one more time. So we're hoping that it'll be similar to the first bill that went down in defeat, about 198 to 213. And we had a couple of New York Congress members voting against that bill. One was Peter King, and the other one was John Katko from Syracuse. So we're really kind of focused on Congressman Donovan right now and urging him to change his vote in support of these punitive measures to vote against them.
And in addition to these new work requirements and so forth, is there any sort of general across-the-board benefit cut that people on food stamps will have to worry about?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot that people are going to have to worry about in this new bill. And, you know, one of the more interesting things was, you know, the bill was almost designed to be punitive. It's automatically going to result in people losing benefits, partly because of work requirements, partly because of other issues. But interestingly enough, the Senate really came up with a very bipartisan approach to food stamps and the reauthorization of the Farm Bill. And they worked together, Republicans and Democrats, and they actually came up with a bill that strengthens the program rather than harms the program. So they realized that they shouldn't be doing things to basically try and eviscerate SNAP, but rather should be strengthening SNAP because it's been such a successful program in keeping seniors and children and families from going hungry in this country. And by, you know, we are one of the wealthiest countries on the face of the globe, and we shouldn't be having our residents going hungry.
Now, you mentioned the Farm Bill, which is the vehicle by which this is being played, this issue is being played out. It has a fairly long bipartisan history. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
The Farm Bill? Yeah, I mean, I think there's always been bipartisan support for the Farm Bills, and, you know, in particular on the Senate side, and even so on the House side. I think, you know, Republicans and Democrats have worked together to make sure that this program continues. And they also, there's a lot of other agricultural provisions in the Farm Bill that get passed year after year. So it is one of those, you know, policies and programs that tends to have broader bipartisan support. But I think, you know, for some reason, I think a lot of members of Congress, in particular on the House side, are looking to try and garner points with their base, I think, for being tough on people who are on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. So, you know, we're pretty concerned about that. It seems like, you know, there's no reason, for instance, that a Dan Donovan should be voting for this bill, right? I mean, he's got literally 38,000 households in his district on the SNAP program right now. 20% of the children in his district are living in poverty. And let's keep in mind, too, that this is kind of an economic stimulus. There's about 750 food stamp retailers or stores that accept food stamps in his district as well. So you're talking about a loss of jobs if these cuts go through.
Yeah, it was. How is it that the food stamp program ended up in a farm bill? Because people ask me that sometimes.
Well, I'm not exactly sure how it eventually, you know, ultimately how it got into the Farm Bill in the beginning, but it's been in the Farm Bill for quite some time. And obviously, you know, the Farm Bill and food and nutrition programs seem to be linked these days. So I think it's probably as a result of some horse trading that occurred some time ago.
And what, since it is the Farm Bill, what does the farm lobby, what do farmers say about this proposed change to the food stamp program?
You know, I haven't heard farmers loud and clear, but I certainly know that the Farm Bureau wasn't too excited about a lot of the changes being put forward in this bill. Obviously, they have a potential loss here as well. Right, they're providing food to retailers. There's all sorts of other programs that low-income people can avail themselves of with various farmers market nutrition program benefits and things of that nature. So I think, you know, retailers and farmers should be very concerned if the House bill goes through. I think they should be definitely supporting the bipartisan Senate approach far more.
So in our last minute with you, can you give us a little bit of prospects looking forward? What's the legislative prognosis, shall we say?
So, you know, we're looking at a vote in the House, it looks like, by this Friday at some point. Chances are that there'll be some amendments proposed that would even make things even worse, quite frankly. Some amendments even from John Faso looking to privatize various aspects of the program, which we think is a huge mistake. Our hope is that we can get a few more of our House Republicans in New York to vote against this bill. It's actually going to have some damaging impacts in their districts and on a lot of their constituents, and it's, quite frankly, it's uncalled for.
And on the Senate side, how are things looking there?
You know, obviously our two senators, Gillibrand and Schumer, have been great on this issue. We're hoping that they will push back against any negative Senate amendments that might try and be attached to this bill. It looks like the Senate, it cleared the Senate Agricultural Committee on June 13th. So now they're looking to do a Senate floor vote before the July 4th recess. So our hope is that no terrible amendments will be attached to it and that the Senate bill will pass as is.
And then they'll go into conference and we'll see what happens after July 4th.
Yeah, and then the horse trading begins again.
That's right. Well, thanks for joining us, Ron, on the program and giving us a little bit of an overview of the debate and so forth going on in Congress right now around the future of food stamps.
Thanks so much for having me on.
You're welcome. Now, turning to you, Margarita, we'll get a bit of a catch-up on what's going on around health care issues. When we last spoke a couple, 3 months ago, they had just passed a spending bill, which had some provisions in it around health care. Let's sort of baseline from there. What happened there, and then we can talk about moving forward.
Well, after a lot of haggling, they finally came to agreement on a set of appropriations bills that included a lot of important funding for some of the basic health care services that government provides, so funding for community health centers, the Children's Health Insurance Program, funding for long-term care, a lot of the, sort of basic programs. And we haven't seen much on health care actually happening in Congress for a little while. And, of course, there's a lot happening. It's just not happening through legislation. Now, just recently, we've seen President Trump enact an interesting procedure that's an old procedure. It's called rescission. And this is a mechanism that hasn't been used for 20 years, but it's a mechanism by which the president can look at the budget, find money that's been appropriated, so it's been allocated to programs but hasn't yet been spent, and claw that money back. And, of course, President Trump and the Republicans right now are alleging that they're really concerned. They passed this very large tax package, $1.5 trillion in tax breaks. They're getting a lot of criticism for sort of betraying their party's principles. They are supposed to be the party of small spending, yet they've just really been sending up a storm. To address that, the president has started with what he's calling this first step rescission package. And the package is about $14 billion. About half of it comes out of the Children's Health Insurance Program. So we've seen that move. We're expecting it to move over to the Senate side pretty shortly. And then in terms of other legislation, we are right now in the FY 2019 appropriations process. They haven't gotten to the health care bill. So this is the budget process that's largely playing out behind the scenes. You might not be reading a lot about it in your local papers. But it's really important because the decisions that get made in that budget process will directly impact people's access to services in the states. And they've gotten through about four of the 12 bills that they've been working on. It seems hard to imagine that they would be able to do one big package like they did in March. In fact, the president has said that he won't sign off on a package like that. And so they're doing a series of smaller bills. And one thing that we know already is that the Republicans have proposed basically flat spending on the non-defense, non-discretionary side. So that's all of the programs, the healthcare programs, nursing homes, health, just basic healthcare programs in communities. Flat spending on those programs really equals a cut, right? Because every year there's greater need. We know the population is aging. We have people being born. So we know that the need for healthcare always increases when politicians say that they're not going to increase on the non-discretionary side. It means really that they're not going to keep up with the cost of healthcare needs. So we're watching that closely to see how that process plays out.
And healthcare costs typically are about three times the normal rate of inflation. So that would
absolutely
be quite
yeah
significant.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's kind of underway in Congress. Let's take a look at some of the actions that the Trump administration has been doing on its own. A couple of proposals that they've really moved forward with, I think they're pretty much in place by now, are new options for people to purchase different kinds of insurance products under the Affordable Care Act. What are they, and what do they mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing about the Affordable Care Act that we don't talk about enough, because we talk a lot about how it increased coverage for people and expanded Medicaid, and all of that is very true and very positive. But the other big thing that the Affordable Care Act did was it established rules and standards for insurance companies. So before we had the Affordable Care Act, an insurance company could pretty much sell anything it wanted in a healthcare policy, right? It could be a policy that somebody would buy, and then they would find that their policy didn't actually cover a whole bunch of the healthcare that they needed. The Affordable Care Act changed all of that, right? It created a set of rules by which insurance policies sold on the Affordable Care Act exchanges had to meet a set of criteria, including things like, the 10 essential health benefits, right? 10 basic services. We think of them as basic: maternity care, mental health, prescription drugs, pediatric care, hospitalization, right? Stuff that you would think is pretty basic. But before the Affordable Care Act, that stuff didn't come standard in insurance policies. You'd often have to pay a lot more if you wanted those additional services. So what the administration has been doing is essentially trying to circumvent those rules that really regulate what kinds of products insurance companies can offer and how much they can charge people for them. And that's, of course, really important because we have so many people in the United States that have pre-existing conditions, right? I mean, estimates on pre-existing conditions anywhere from 130 million people to 170 million people, right? It's a lot of people. And pre-existing conditions can be anything from mental illness to opioid addiction to maternity to domestic abuse. I mean, it's pretty much whatever the insurance companies want to characterize as a pre-existing condition that might make somebody more expensive to provide health coverage for. The rules in the Affordable Care Act really work to prevent insurance companies from charging folks with pre-existing conditions more. And the president's actions, HHS's actions over the last few months, have really been to get plans into the exchanges and put them out there for consumers that circumvent a lot of those rules. And so you may be hearing a lot about associated health plans or short-term plans. These are plans that currently under the law can only be available for 3 months. President Trump wants to make them available for a full year. They're cheaper than regular insurance, but that is because they don't cover a lot of the stuff that regular insurance covers, and they don't meet the standard for insurance in a lot of cases under the Affordable Care Act rules. Of course, insurance companies will charge people less for this, but people are getting a lot less coverage. And the reality is that, you know, it really waters down the quality. Insurers also are able to charge people more, right? So they're able to charge people with pre-X, which includes, you know, women, or it includes old people over 50, can charge them more for those plans. So essentially, President Trump is saying, we know we have the Affordable Care Act, but since we don't really support the Affordable Care Act, we are going to allow all these other plans to be sold in the marketplace that don't meet the same standard that the Affordable Care Act plans have had to meet up to this point.
And what's the impact on the market in that situation?
Well, it's, you know, it draws people out of the market, right? And so what happens is, of course, you know, people look at these plans just like, you know, everybody who shops knows that when you're shopping, you're looking for a deal. And that's true whether you're buying jeans or you're buying healthcare. And to a lot of consumers, it might look like a deal, right, to buy one of these short-term plans that covers less, or it may not be obvious that the plan covers less. We know a lot of people don't very thoroughly read their insurance policies. So it might look like a good deal to a lot of people who are, you know, really looking for insurance that's affordable. And as a result, they may choose those plans, drawing people away from the more comprehensive plans and encouraging people to buy outside of the marketplaces. That really weakens the marketplaces because the fewer people that are getting their insurance through the ACA marketplaces, the more expensive that coverage gets, right? The whole, you know, insurance is complex, but basically the way it works is the more people are insured, the bigger the pool, the cheaper the coverage is. To the extent that you cherry pick some people out because they're younger and, you know, they can have insurance that doesn't cover as many things because they think, you know, they're not going to be in danger since they may be healthier, younger people, it increases the cost for the people that are left.
So more recently, the Department of Justice came out with a legal brief sort of saying that because of the new tax law, the whole ACA is now unconstitutional. What's that all about?
Well, it is about more of the same, right? It is about the Republicans and President Trump have not made any secret of the fact that they want the ACA gone. They've tried to repeal it in Congress, both the House and the Senate, and they failed. They did a partial repeal of a piece of the law in the tax bill. They've been doing all of these administrative things to water down coverage that we just talked about. And most lately, they have been, you know, they have basically said, we're going to refuse to uphold the law. The Department of Justice suit that you're talking about was a set of 20, you know, 20 states that are claiming that because a portion of the Affordable Care Act was repealed to pay for tax breaks for corporations in the law, now the whole law is invalid. So the reality is, of course, we know that it takes more than repealing one provision of the Affordable Care Act to invalidate the law. The law has already been declared constitutional at least twice in the Supreme Court. And Congress, if they had wanted to do more, right, if they had wanted to do a greater repeal, certainly has had the opportunity to do that. So these states are arguing in their case that the law is now unconstitutional because the penalty associated with the individual mandate has been repealed. But the reality is, of course, that the individual mandate itself has not been repealed, but the penalty has just been zeroed out. So the law stands intact. It's still functional. People are still enrolled. People are still getting their health care. And really what this amounts to is sort of the latest political attack. And the fact that the Department of Justice is refusing to uphold the law of the land, I think, is evidence of, you know, what their true agenda has always been, which is to get rid of the Affordable Care Act by any means that they can.
And that'll be litigated through the courts for a couple of years, I presume, at least. Lastly, there's a new potential repeal and replace bill on the horizon. Anything to it?
Well, we'll see. It does seem, nuts. But you know, there has been a group of Republican advisors led by Rick Santorum you know, who's previously a legislator in Pennsylvania, really urging Republicans in Congress to, you know, once again take up the issue of repeal. I mean, of course, this is totally contradictory to what every poll in America is telling us, which is that, you know, people want Congress to work together to undo the damage that they've already done by, you know, creating all this uncertainty in the market and driving up premiums. But, you know, they've been talking about this for a number of months. There's supposed to be a white paper that's going to be released today, and they are really looking for legislators to take it up. Now, it's not clear whether or not legislators would take it up. It seems more likely that legislators in the House would take it up than the Senate. The Senate, you know, as everybody knows, right, it's a much more moderate body than the House. And I think, you know, the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, doesn't seem to have as much of an appetite to take this up. I will say people are taking the white paper and the lobbying from these Republicans more seriously, since we've all heard that the budget chairman, Steve Womack, has put together a budget resolution. Now, people will remember when we worked on stopping repeal last year that we talked about it as ACA repeal, but the legislative vehicle for that repeal was a budget resolution that included reconciliation instructions, which basically just meant a fast-track budget. And we know that Chairman Womack is working on a similar vehicle right now. So that would give us, that gives us more pause, because now we have a set of thinkers and Republican advisors and strategists talking about why it's important in this critical election year to continue to rally the Republican base around repeal. And we have actually in the House the potential for an actual legislative vehicle to move it. So that's more worrisome. You know, I think one thing we've all learned over the past year is that most of the sort of protocols and process that we had come to view as rules here in Washington really don't apply these days. So I think we have to be really vigilant, because we've seen on these repeal bills in the past lots of folks theorizing that no, it couldn't happen, it's crazy, they wouldn't do that, it's insane, it's political suicide, and then they have moved forward multiple times even though their efforts failed. So we're really keeping a pretty close eye on this, because the combination of a white paper, Republican donors and thinkers urging their colleagues who are actually legislators in the House, I think is a pretty dangerous, you know, it's like leaving a lit cigarette next to a can of gasoline. So we really need to keep an eye on that.
Sure. Well, thank you very much. We've been getting an update on health care bills and what's happening in Congress around that. We've been speaking with Margarita George, co-executive director of Healthcare for America Now. Thanks for joining us again on Health Action, Margarita.
Thanks, Mark. Great to be here.
Yep. And we'll be back with our second interview segment, taking a look at consumers' rights about concerning health insurers' new rate requests for next year, 2019. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In our second interview today, we're going to be taking a look at consumers' rights concerning health insurers' new rate requests for next year, for 2019. Joining us to help us sort all that out, and it's a little bit in the weeds, so hang with us here, is Amanda Dunker, a health policy associate with the Community Service Society of New York. Welcome back, Amanda.
Thanks, Mark.
And we've had you on the program, I think, talking about this in previous years. So we're up to the 2018 edition, looking forward to 2019. Before we get into any of the particulars, let's just kind of broadly describe what's happening here. Every year, insurers have to submit their rate requests to the state for review. Tell us a little bit about the process.
Sure. So like you said, in New York, insurers have to, in the individual and small group plans, they have to submit applications to the state of New York In New York, the body that looks at those applications is called the Department of Financial Services. So I'll say DFS for the rest of this talk. But, you know, DFS then posts all of those applications. So all of that material is available to the public. And then DFS is allowed to tell them, no, you're asking for too much. You know, like the numbers you've provided in your application, we see places where we think you should lower it. And so DFS each year has actually lowered the requests that the insurers make for their rates.
So it's a bit of a dance. The insurers pad their requests a little bit, and then the state cuts them back a little bit.
Sure. And sometimes the state's able to do that because after they see what the other insurers say, they can point out, you know, like your request in this area is a lot higher than everybody else. So it doesn't look appropriate to us that you asked for that much. The other aspect of this process in New York is that not only are the materials available to the public is invited and encouraged to submit their own thoughts and comments on what your specific plan is asking for. So everybody who has one of these plans that's subject to this process gets a letter in the mail that says, you know, what the insurance company is asking for this year for the plan that you have.
And then I am actually one of those people who got one of those letters. So what do I do when I get the letter?
Right. So hopefully the letter gives you some guidance on where you can submit your comments. But if it's not clear, you do it through the Department of Financial Services website. It's a little bit complicated to find the right spot. So we have posted instructions for finding where you can submit your public comments. The way you can find our instructions to do that are if you go to the website, it's hcfany.org, and go to the blog, you'll find a blog post that sort of describes the situation and gives you some direct links to the application and where you can submit your comments.
Right, and that's the website of Healthcare for All New York, which is a consumer coalition. So you could just in your search engine put in Healthcare for All New York and then go to the blog page. And yeah, it is a little, it's not at all particularly user-friendly. I took a quick look at it and I was like, what?
So. Right, and we're hoping in the letters you get to that they'll explain to you where you can go.
Right.
They're not always that helpful for
and you can also do a good old-fashioned way by regular postal mail if you want to make those comments. And when do people have to put their comments in?
So it's a very short time period. The comments went up June 1st. The public only has 30 days to comment. So 30 days from June 1st is July 1st, which is next Monday.
A week from Monday, actually. Right. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so I got one of these letters, and I'm mulling it over and so forth. Let's take a look sort of what the insurers have actually asked for. And we'll focus mainly on the plans that are in the greater New York area, the insurers that provide coverage in those areas, because I think that's where most of our listenership is. The biggest one is Fidelis Health Plan, which coincidentally is being sold to a for-profit company, and all that has just been approved by the state. But that's another topic for another time. But they have about 100,000 New Yorkers enrolled in their plan. What are they asking for, and what's their rationale that they're putting forward?
So Fidelis is asking for, on average, a 38.6% increase in rates, which is by far the biggest. Fidelis is one of the, you know, traditionally Fidelis, it's a nonprofit plan. It's one of the lowest cost options New Yorkers have. As you just said, they've been sold to a for-profit company. As part of that sale getting approved, you know, that was another process where the state got to weigh in and approve it or not approve it. They promised they wouldn't raise rates for a few years. And so, you know, I suspect part of the reason that they asked for such a huge rate increase this year is because that way they can start off next year when ownership has fully been transferred over to this for-profit company, they can start off a lot higher than they've had. The valid arguments, well, the potentially like more valid arguments they're making to raise the rates so much are, one is a little bit of a complicated situation, which I'm going to try to explain as best I can. But you know, as most of your listeners probably know, the federal government has made a lot of, you know, what we characterize as attacks on this individual market. One of the only things they succeeded in actually doing last year, if you remember, they had all those bills to try and repeal the ACA. They were not able to repeal the ACA. what they the only part of the ACA they were really able to get rid of was the individual mandate, which is a penalty people have to pay through their taxes if they choose to go without insurance. So the reason a plan like Fidelis, which is a kind of a low-cost plan, would say that losing that mandate means their rates have to go up a lot, is because, you know, the purpose of the mandate is to convince people who are on the fence about buying health insurance to buy a plan. So the classic scenario is like a younger person who's thinking, you know, even these lower cost plans are pretty expensive for me at this point in my life. I don't go to the doctor a lot. Maybe I just won't buy a plan and I'll take that risk of having some sort of health emergency without insurance. It's really important now that insurance companies cannot deny coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. It's really important to get those younger people or those people who don't anticipate using their insurance much to buy plans. You know, their premiums kind of subsidize that care for the people with pre-existing conditions. You know, and there's a benefit to them because some of them will have health emergencies. But from the point of making a plan function and keeping plans in the market, we really need them to be paying premiums so that we can afford to provide care to those people who have pre-existing conditions.
Yeah, I think the basic insurance principle there is that at any given moment in time, not a lot of people necessarily need a lot of healthcare services, but at some point in time, everybody will need healthcare services,
right.
And so that's why you carry insurance.
Yep. Yeah, and so, but the next question is, what plans will those people buy? And they're probably not going to buy the most expensive plans. So some of the really expensive plans in New York, like United is on average the most expensive, or Empire on average is the most expensive. Like, that's probably not the plan that those people are going to buy. But Fidelis is on average the cheapest option in New York. And so Fidelis has kind of a good argument there, saying we think we're getting some of those people who are on the fence and are only buying insurance because they don't want to pay the penalty. And so we think we might, you know, we might lose customers next year, or we might, you know, the customers that we still have left are going to be people who use their insurance more. And so that's, you know, that's why they're saying they need to jack their rates up so much. We you know, HCFANI, Healthcare for All New York, the coalition, like, we've been really worried about losing the mandate ever since this change in the federal administration. It is an important strategy for keeping healthcare affordable for people who used to be considered uninsurable, but we're also not sure that losing the mandate is as important as some of these plans are arguing, including Fidelis. 23% increase due to the mandate repeal is a really, it's the highest. It's much bigger than anybody else is asking for. And when I've looked at the applications and I've looked at plans that I think are kind of similar to Fidelis, like similar price points, they're asking for much less. I think Oscar is sort of similar. They're saying that they only need a 7% bump to make up for losing the mandate. It is bad that we're losing the mandate, but I think that a lot of people with these plans have some room to argue that the plan is overplaying it a little bit.
And it'll be interesting kind of, you know, 6-12 months from now to sort of see if that really comes to be true, because even last year, although the mandate was nominally still on the books, the Trump administration had announced that they weren't going to enforce the mandate. And so at that point, there was sort of an opportunity, if people wanted to forego having insurance coverage, they could do so. And yet when we saw the enrollment numbers for this year, actually the numbers were higher. People kept their insurance and more people signed up. So it may be the kind of thing of, even if this mandate goes away, by now that we're sort of 6 years into this new Affordable Care Act era, if you will, that people understand the value of carrying coverage, whether there's a penalty or a mandate or not. So that'll be sort of interesting to see. Let's take a look. You mentioned Oscar. They've got a lot of people. They've got over 50,000 people in their plan. What are they proposing?
So Oscar's proposing another big increase. They're asking for 28.6%. Again, Oscar's one of those plans it's one of the more affordable options in New York. I think on average it's like the second lowest monthly cost for people. They're saying 7% of that 28.6% is because of losing the mandate. So again, you know, they're saying we think we're getting a lot of those customers that don't use insurance a lot and are just buying plans because they don't want to break the rules. They want to buy a plan and not pay the penalty. So we're going to lose some of those people. So we think our average costs are going to go up a little bit for the people who are still left. But otherwise, it's kind of hard to see why Oscar really thinks they need a rate increase that's that large. Something I noticed about Oscar's application is that if you look through their application, you'll see something called an expense ratio. Expense ratio is the money that they pay. Part of it is like taxes and stuff they have to pay, and the other part of it is their administrative costs, like overhead, advertising, that type of thing. Theirs is 17%, and that's kind of high compared to some of the other ones. It's the highest this year. And so I think if I had Oscar, I would ask why is their admin so expensive? They're claiming they're losing money. So it's kind of hard. If they're saying they're losing money, it's kind of hard to argue that they don't need a rate increase, but, you might say something like they could definitely do a better job controlling their admin costs because their admin costs are a lot higher than everybody else's.
And they are a relatively brand new insurance company. They launched when the new Affordable Care Act marketplace is opened, and they've had a bit of a rocky start. So I think it seems to be that they're gradually getting stabilized a little bit. So we'll sort of see how that all plays out. Then we have a bunch of plans that are all, in terms of enrollment numbers, in the same ballpark. We've got Empire Blue Cross. It's got about 26,000 members. We've got Health First. It's got about 29,000. We've got Emblem Health. That's got about 22,000. And we've got Metro Plus that's got about 14,000. So what are all those? They're kind of in the same region. What are they looking like for next year?
So this is always one of the most interesting things about the rate review process. Like, if you pull out some important factors in the applications and look at them at all the plans across the board, even plans that you would think would have very similar requests, they're all over the board. So that's how we build our arguments a lot of times. So, for example, Empire, Blue Cross Blue Shield, is asking for 24%. They're already a fairly expensive plan, but if you look at, let's see, one of the other plans you just mentioned that's similarly sized, MVP, they're only asking for a 6.5% increase. And so, of course, there's differences in benefit design and how good they are at advertising and who they get to enroll, but we still think there should be more standardization between the plans, especially with two plans that are operating in the same market in the New York City area. So that's something I would comment on if you're in one of those plans. It's just the range is about 6% all the way up to 24%. So if you got that letter and you're at the top end of that range, I would say something in my public comment about, why can other plans do such a better job than mine at controlling costs?
And I guess that's an important point, because for each of these companies, they've got an average rate increase that has been put out there. But they all offer different plans, so you really have to look at what plan you're in, and they can range from quite high to quite inexpensive, and depending on the tier level you pick and so forth like that. So it's not just sort of one thing for the entire company. That's just an average.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would add, if you followed the discussion earlier about the individual mandate, if you're in I said Fidelis has a fairly good argument for why that will cause them to raise premiums, even if, I think they're asking for too much. But if you have a Fidelis plan and you're in one of their more expensive plans, you might also say something in your comments about the fact that, I don't think people are buying, the platinum level plan because of the mandate. And so, yes, it makes sense to share costs across your entire portfolio, but you might say something like, I have a platinum plan. I don't think that my fellow members in this plan are buying insurance just because of the mandate, and so I don't see why the mandate should mean that I have such a large increase.
Right. Okay, so in the last few minutes, this process will play itself out. The public comment period will close at the end of this month. Then what happens?
So then DFS... The timeline's a little bit different every year, but sometimes it takes a couple weeks, a few weeks. DFS will announce what the rates actually are. They've always reduced the rates somewhat. In the past couple years, it's been smaller reductions. But we try to point out to people, you know, even if DFS only reduces the rates overall by like 3%, we're talking about so much money that it's millions of dollars for consumers, right?
Mm-hmm.
The public comments will also be posted. And so that's another reason why we think the public part of the process is so important. It's not that DFS can necessarily take what you're saying and force them to lower their rates just based on, you know, like public anger about how expensive plans are, right? They do have to look at their applications and the numbers they're provided and then come up with something that is based on, you know, that sort of analysis. But when you provide when you submit a comment on the rates and you talk about how your family is affected by expensive premiums, how you've been affected by the fact that premiums keep going up by double-digit percentages every single year, it's then posted for everyone to see and it's part of the public record. And I think it's really important that process occurs and that people have told their own stories and added to the discussion publicly.
And I will say, you know, for whatever one can say, good, bad, or otherwise, about so-called, quote-unquote, government bureaucrats, my assessment of this has been over the years that the Department of Financial Services really does pay attention to public comments on this stuff, both from advocate groups like Healthcare for All New York, as well as individual people. And it does make a difference. So I really want to encourage people, if you got one of these letters, you know, to make your comment, even if it's just a few paragraphs that you put on a piece of paper and send off in the mail. It does make a difference. Lastly, let's say so the new rates will come out at some point late summer, early fall, and so forth. And assuming the rates are going to go up some, we don't know how much the state's going to improve. As you indicated, this has kind of been a year-by-year trend, and it's been going up and up and up. What are some things that the state can really do kind of on a larger scale that can step in and sort of mitigate this situation of ever-increasing rates?
So one thing we've seen a nearby state do, New Jersey, is impose its own statewide individual mandate. So that's definitely an option New York could pursue. It's not the option we're most excited about, just because, you know, we understand the mandate's really unpopular, and also we think the mandate is not as important as some other more consumer-friendly options for getting healthier people into the market, right? Those healthy people whose premiums can then help us afford care for anybody who has a serious health problem or emergency. The option we think the state could pursue that would be the fastest and the most affordable would be more premium assistance for people who earn too much right now to currently receive help. A way to do that the most cheaply would be to just offer that premium assistance to young people. You know, and then we would get them into the market, and then having that bigger market that has more of those younger people who might not use our insurance as much would help control prices a lot. But we would also, of course, like to see more premium assistance for everybody. There's just a lot of people, I think, regardless of the mandate, actually just cannot afford some of the prices that they're seeing. And so we think premium assistance would be even more effective than a statewide individual mandate. So that's what we think is the best option for keeping prices down, or at least stopping them from increasing so much every year. We also really, really would like to see the state create a more affordable public option for people. And so some states are talking about doing that with their Medicaid programs and allowing members of the public who aren't eligible for Medicaid to buy into Medicaid, buy Medicaid plans.
Which are usually much cheaper, mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
Yeah.
We have something that's a step above Medicaid called the Essential Plan. And so what we'd like to see most of all, even more than premium assistance, is a way for people to buy into our Essential Plan. Right now, it's great coverage. It's really comprehensive coverage. It's based on income. So the people who have the Essential Plan now, some of them pay nothing. And if you make a little bit more money, you pay at most $20 a month for it. If we open the Essential Plan up to more people, you know, we would subsidize the premiums based on income. So the more you make, the more you pay. And at the top earning levels, like, people might even just be paying the full premium. But right now, the costs for the Essential Plan are like $400 a month or something like that. And it's really great coverage. It's very comprehensive coverage. So it's better than most of the options people have in the individual market.
Great. Well, thank you very much. Before we wrap up, tell us one more time where people can get information on the Healthcare for All New York blog.
Yep. So it's the Healthcare for All New York Coalition. So you can just Google Healthcare for All New York, or you can go to hcfany.org.
And go to the blog, and then there's instructions to help you submit your comments to the state online, because it is a bit of an arcane process.
Yep, and some examples, too.
Right, exactly. Well, thank you very much. We've been talking about consumers' rights concerning health insurers' new rate requests for next year. Our guest has been Amanda Dunker, Health Policy Associate with the Community Service Society of New York. Thanks so much for joining us on Health Action, Amanda.
Thanks for the invitation.
And thank you for joining us on Health Action this week. Next week, we'll be bringing you our annual LGBT Pride Health Special, so join us back for then. Thanks to Reggie Johnson for engineering and editing this program. I'm Mark Hanna.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, in studio with our co-host, Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we are rejoined by world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual, Professor Henry Giroux. We'll discuss his latest book from City Lights Books' Open Media Series on today's program. The title, American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. Stay with us.
Is this where you wait for the bus to Luxembourg?
Yes, I'm taking the bus to Luxembourg.
Well, I'm not going to stay in Luxembourg.
Me either. I'm taking the train to Paris.
Well, me too. Are you going to stay in Paris?
No, I'm flying on to New York.
Well, I'm flying on to New York.
Brooklyn, really?
I'm going to Brooklyn.
What for?
To see John McDonough's Off the Meter at the Brooklyn Common.
Tales of a New York City cab driver.
Saturday night, June 23rd.
Me too.
Oh, really?
The great Malachi McCord is a special guest star.
I know. I can't wait.
Show starts at 7. Tickets are available at WBAI.org.
I got my tickets.
Me too. Off the Meter is a benefit performance for WBAI.
I know. I don't want to miss it.
You won't, but first...
But first what?
Don't miss the bus.
If you miss the bus to John McDonough's Off the Meter, take a taxi.
We are locking people up for fighting for 15 while corporate crooks are going free. 8 million poor working people not having health care because of governors and legislators denying Medicaid expansion. 30,000 people are dying every year, not because it was their time to die, but because a governor or a legislature would not give them health care.
You've been listening to Reverend William Barber leading the revival of Reverend King's 1968 Poor People's Campaign. King's triple evils of war, poverty, and racism are as relevant today as then. The campaign is holding a massive rally and march in Washington, D.C., Saturday, June 23rd. WBAI will proudly broadcast it from 1 to 6 p.m., with studio anchoring by Crossroads producer Reverend Sam Cruz and field reporting by Building Bridges, Mimi Rosenberg, and Ken Nett.
Hello, listeners. I'm WBAI's General Manager, Berto Reimers. I'm happy to announce that we have successfully moved out of the Empire State Building and are now transmitting from 4 Times Square. This is a major accomplishment and a turning point in our history, with a savings to WBI of 50%.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, complete with rain. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, three stories by Robert Checkley, all from Untouched by Human Hands, brought to us via Skyboat Media. It'll be a lot of fun. Stay tuned. Yes, this is Hour of the Wolf. No absolutely set agenda, but yesterday I was talking with my colleagues, people that I do editing work for and have occasionally done audiobook work for. I actually work, if you can call it that, I'm the host of Lightspeed Magazine podcast. And so I actually report to John Joseph Adams, but he in turn hires Skyboat Media to create the podcast, which has so far gotten two Hugo Awards and is no longer really eligible because technically it's a semi-prozine as opposed to a prozine. And it's not a fanzine, so it's you know, somewhere in between, and you can't vote for it anymore. At any rate, but I've also worked, Skyboat Media has also put out a ton of great science fiction in audiobooks. I have edited, I've produced two. One of them is my own, called Chatting Science Fiction, which are interviews that are not from Hour of the Wolf. They are interviews that I have done at conventions and things like that. And maybe one of these years I can interest them in stuff from Hour of the Wolf. Who knows? but that's premature to talk about. But Stefan Rupnicki and Gabrielle DeCure run Skyboat Media, and they're doing a fundraiser for themselves on drip.com. I have an actual address, which I don't have out with me yet, but I will give it to you shortly. I was too busy schmoozing with Max and then wondering why, when I click the Chrome icon, Mozilla comes up. I'm going to have to do something about that. I don't like Mozilla. I like Chrome. Anyway, they said, well, why don't we give you some stuff to play? And the first thing that they offered me were three stories, three of my favorite stories by Robert Sheckley. Now, anybody who's listened to this show, you know, as many as four or five times has probably heard me praising Sheckley all over the place. I mean, the most recent time was we played episodes of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I have to remind Max I need a better copy of that. And the a character and situation in Hitchhiker's Guide from the Galaxy is taken straight from an episode in one of Sheckley's novels. He was a brilliant writer of parody, satire, and sarcasm, his best era being late 50s through the early 70s. We did a tribute for him at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, which included Ziva Quitney, his wife, or I should say a wife, but as far as I'm concerned, the wife, and Elisa Quitney, who listeners may have heard on this show a couple of times, who, aside from being Sheckley's daughter, is a brilliant novelist in her own right and a collaborator and sometimes editor of Neil Gaiman's and stuff like that there. I have to get Elise on the show live. I've had her on recording at least twice, actually three times. So we'll need to get her here live. And she's a wonderful writer herself. Her current novel is, I think, A Court and Queen. I will have to look that up again. It's humorous supernatural fiction. Anyway, supernatural romance fiction at that. So before we get to the offerings given us by Skyboat Media, let me promote our next New York Review of Science Fiction reading, which will be on July 3rd. Now, I know, yeah, July 3rd is the day before July 4th, but the following week would be July 10th, and it's just inconvenient because that's the point that I'll be getting ready, like, you know, the next day or the day after that, to be going to my favorite convention of the year, which is ReaderCon. And so that Wednesday night, in fact, Ken Gale will be hosting this show. And I think he's already told me who he's having on, and I already forgot. But, well, you'll be finding out more as we get closer to that date. So the reading is on July 3rd, and the guest curator for that evening, for July 3rd, is Amy Goldschlager. And she has selected for us, she has curated for us, David Mack and Seth Dickinson. Let's do them in alphabetical order. Seth Dickinson is the author of The Traitor Baru Cormorant and its forthcoming sequel, The Monster Baru Cormorant. He studied racial bias in police shootings, wrote much of the lore for Bungle Studios' Destiny, and helped write and design the open-source space opera Blue Planet. Were he an animal, he would be a cockatoo. Okay? And we don't need all of you telling me what kind of, you know, parrot-like bird, your bird of paradise you might be. I'll have to think about that myself. The other one, David Mack, who was actually on this show, about 10 weeks ago. David Mack is the award-winning and New York Times bestselling author of more than 30 novels of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure, including the Star Trek Destiny and Cold Equations trilogies. His writing credits span several media, including television, for episodes of Star Trek DS9, film, short fiction, and comic books. He resides, as opposed to lives, in New York City. So that's this coming July 3rd, Tuesday, July 3rd, here at 388 Atlantic Avenue. Admission is free. We do ask for donations to help fund the reading series. And I trust and hope you will show up. We've been having a run of really good events, and I can tell you that's a trend that is not slowing down. We're pretty much booked, except for 1 month. We are booked through next January. So with really good stuff, if I say so myself. I'll get around to trying to organize myself and posting it all. But I usually wait until after ReaderCon to do that, because it's at ReaderCon that I run into people and say, you're it. I go trolling. So mostly I'll have to troll for interviews.